You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Shashank Joshi joins us in the studio to set the day's agenda with a South Asian twist. Shashank, what will we be talking about today?
I thought we'd talk about India and Pakistan, of course. India is having a very important week. You're seeing a huge operation to flush out militants in Kashmir. Pakistan's having a very big week. The army chief has just said he'll resign. And then Afghanistan, which is almost a playground for the two countries, I thought we'd talk about how the diplomacy is going.
Looking forward to that. That'll be a fascinating discussion, no doubt. And the United Nations are being sued for bringing cholera to Haiti in 2008 via its peacekeeping mission. As lawyers demand compensation of $100,000 for everyone who died and $50,000 for everyone who became ill, the UN is claiming immunity. So where does this end?
The UN will undoubtedly contest the jurisdiction of the court. So I think this is a bit of a long struggle, but not as long as the struggle of Haitians against cholera.
We examine how artists contribute to our perceptions of conflict as we speak to Sarah Bevan, the curator of a major new exhibition of contemporary art and war at the Imperial War Museum in Manchester.
And we'll head over to Istanbul, where entire neighbourhoods known as Geisha Kondo spring to life overnight.
This is a miracle. This is the solution. People solve their own housing needs. Turkish state managed to build so many numbers of houses in 1 year, but Geisha Kondo people, they managed 10 times more.
All that, plus we spin some great music too. All to come here in the next hour on Midori House. It's 2 minutes past eight here in London. We have lots to get through over the next hour, but before we get underway, let's hear the latest news headlines from around the world with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zeidan has been seized by armed men in the capital Tripoli. Mr. Zeidan was taken from the Carinthia Hotel at dawn by gunmen to an unknown place for unknown reasons, according to a statement on the government's website. The details are unclear. Sources say Mr. Zeidan was arrested by an anti-crime militia allied to the government, but others that he had been kidnapped. There's speculation the event is linked to the capture of Anas al-Libi, a senior al-Qaeda suspect in Libya, by US forces. The government has come under pressure to explain how US commandos were able to seize al-Libi last Saturday. The United States says it will withhold deliveries of tanks, fighter aircraft, helicopters and missiles, as well as $260 million in cash aid from Egypt's military-backed government, pending progress on democracy and human rights. The decision, described by US officials, demonstrates US unhappiness with Egypt's path since its army ousted Mohamed Morsi in July. The head of the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog says the Syrian government has so far been very cooperative with its inspectors. Ahmet Uzumcu, Director General of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, says experts still have much work to do, but he's confident that they could eliminate Syria's chemical weapons by mid-2014. The media rights group Reporters Without Borders has confirmed that two more French journalists are being held hostage in Syria, taking the number of its captive citizens in the country to four. The two men, Nicolas Hanin, who was working for Le Point magazine, and Pierre Torre, who was reporting for French-German television channel Arte, were taken on June the 22nd, but their disappearance had not previously been made public. Swazi Dole, the head of RSF's Middle East desk, says foreign journalists in Syria face constant danger.
There's 15 foreign journalists actually detained, kidnapped or missing in Syria, and more than 60 journalists, Syrian journalists actually also detained by the regime, and more than 12 kidnapped by opposition group, mainly jihadist group.
The father of fugitive former US intelligence contractor Edward Snowden has arrived in Russia to visit his son. Lon Snowden told journalists on his arrival in Moscow that he felt extreme gratitude that his son was safe and secure. India's trade deficit fell to 2.5-year low in September, raising hopes for a significant reduction in the country's gaping current account deficit, which sent the rupee to record lows in recent months. Imports fell by 18.1%, while exports were up by 11.15%, bringing the trade gap down from $10.9 billion in August to $6.7 billion last month. Trade Secretary S.R. Rao says he's confident that better times are ahead.
Going forward, I'm confident the import containment measures put in place by government for non-essential imports is playing out extremely well, and we need to continue this so that our rupee becomes stronger.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to James Luckhurst. He'll be back at the bottom of the hour to update the headlines for us. Right, it's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London, London.
Isto é Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vai a City Check. From London,
London. London, caralho.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London. And at 6 minutes past eight, it's time for us to set the day's agenda. Today, our focus is on South Asia. And joining us in the studio is Shashank Joshi from the think tank, the Royal United Services Institute. Shashank, thanks so much for being here. Let's start with India and Pakistan and that vexed border between them, Kashmir. It's claimed, of course, in its entirety by both countries. It's been a flashpoint for over 60 years. And now India has spent the last fortnight flushing out what it claims are Pakistani militants. So what's the latest?
Well, for the past 10 years, there's been a ceasefire on the so-called line of control because both sides agree where that line is. They don't agree where it should be, but they agree where it is. And that's kept things in check. And now, just as Prime Minister Manmohan Singh of India and Nawaz Sharif of Pakistan, newly elected, of course, have opened up a channel of dialogue. They spoke and met at the United Nations sidelines General Assembly last week. You're seeing suddenly huge infiltrations take place into Kashmir, stuff we haven't seen for years. I'm sure people remember the Kargil conflict in 1999. Well, in India, some people are talking about this latest operation in the Karen sector of Kashmir as a Kargil light. That is a huge campaign. It's taken 2 weeks for the Indian army to clear these people out of villages using pretty heavy fire. So this isn't any small skirmishing. It's a two-week operation, 30 to 40 people, and on the whole, 30 to 40 people cannot get across into Kashmir without a little bit of covering fire from the Pakistan army, which is, of course, a tried and tested technique. So the danger is that these are moves at the military level that could spiral upwards to the political level, which on the whole is going rather well, or at least nothing is going wrong.
But both India and Pakistan say that they have nuclear capability. So, I mean, potentially this makes this one of the most dangerous conflicts in the world.
Yes, I mean, both of them have pretty nascent nuclear capabilities. But yeah, Pakistan's nuclear arsenal is the fastest growing in the world. It's developing tactical nuclear weapons. I mean, it's not even worth talking about a conflict at this stage. This is within India's notional boundaries. It's still not a war per se, but it's easy to see how events like this can escalate. It's a series of events. Earlier in the year, we had an alleged beheading of an Indian soldiers by Pakistanis. We had Pakistanis killed by Indian raids. So the danger is that ceasefire I talked about, which really brought violence down from its peak in the 90s and early noughties, that may be slowly falling apart.
Well, you mentioned how the political developments have been healthier, shall we say. Not so long ago, both Indian and Pakistani prime ministers were agreeing to diffuse tensions. They were meeting in New York on the sidelines of UNGA, the UN General Assembly. How much does this latest, the past fortnight, as you say, not just a skirmish, much, much bigger deal, how much does that set back those political negotiations?
Well, a little bit. We already had another scandal last week at UNGA when Sharif made a supposedly rude comment about Singh, and that really resonated. But the Indian media is very jingoistic, very tabloid-like in its willingness to take up these causes and back bash the government for saying, why are you talking to Pakistan when they're murdering our boys in the field? You know, really tough stuff on the government. And of course, there are elections coming up in India next year. And as in any country, but particularly in India, elections overshadow all of this. And so it's politically very difficult to say, well, you know, the Pakistan army is helping to kill our soldiers, but okay, I'll talk to Sharif. So I think it means we're not going to get anywhere in the dialogue, if we were anyway, until after we have a new government with a fresh mandate in place.
Shashank, let's move on to Afghanistan, because very interesting things going on there. What do you have for us?
Well, in Afghanistan, there's two aspects of the diplomacy I think are interesting to keep an eye on. One of them is there's a trilateral summit coming up between us, the UK, and Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's the fourth such summit we've hosted. It's an effort to basically squeeze the two sides together and say, look, sort your differences out. Afghans really don't trust Pakistanis. They see them as the wellspring of the Taliban insurgency, and it really their founders. And Pakistan don't trust the Afghans, of course. In addition to that, it's been a very, very big week because a really top Taliban commander, Mullah Baradar, who is number two in the Taliban, the co-founder with Mullah Omar, was released last week by Pakistan after years in custody, ostensibly to help the peace process. So he can talk to the Afghan government, he can talk to the Americans and sort of say, well, how can we make some progress on a political settlement to the conflict? In reality, he's vanished.
Go ahead.
Nobody knows where he is, which means the Pakistanis may still be playing their game.
Interesting. Can we also talk a bit about the election? Because the race to succeed Karzai in next April's election currently looks wide open. We've had many, many new people flooding to put their names down. Six serious candidates, one of whom is incredibly controversial, Abdul Rasul Sayaf. He invited Osama bin Laden into Afghanistan in 1996. He was described also as the mentor of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, of course, the mastermind of 9/11. How significant is it that a figure like that, who will draw such international opprobrium, is actually on the ballot sheet and quite a serious candidate?
It's unhelpful, as diplomats would say, because, of course, the future of Afghanistan... We're leaving at the end of next year. We're putting trainers in, but we're off. It depends on the Afghan National Army, and that depends on money, about $4 to $6 billion per year flowing in. Now, you try telling MPs or congressmen or congresswomen, look, sorry, you've got to stump up $6 billion in cash to a man who's a former warlord, blood on his hands. Now, of course, they're all former warlords to one extent or the other here, but Rasayev particularly. And how do you do this? Now, some of them, of course, he may be better than Karzai, who last week said NATO is a source of great suffering in Afghanistan and I'll reconcile with the Taliban without you and all of these things. So in some ways, Karzai has been a massive thorn in our side, and it's possible anyone but Karzai might be a better interlocutor for NATO, for the Americans, for us. But it's not really about who wins, I think, although this will create problems if you have a very corrupt candidate. It's about how they win. And if the election is fraudulent, or if there's ballot stuffing on the scale of last time, it doesn't matter who wins, however technocratic and Western-friendly in English-speaking they are. That's going to make it very hard to fulfill those international commitments to the Afghan state.
Has Karzai actually publicly supported anybody yet? Because he said that he won't, but there are indications that perhaps there's a wavering there.
We don't know who he's supporting. His own brother has thrown in for the running, but Karzai said he won't support his brother. Right now, I think Karzai's keeping his lines open. He's seeing which way this goes. The stakes are pretty high for him. He's built his own little sort of granny house on the grounds of the presidential palace to live off and sort of shout at the news, his successor from the sidelines. But actually, he could be, you know, several Afghan presidents have ended up hanging from lampposts, and he knows that. So it matters to him who wins and whether they'll be kindly disposed to him. So I think he's playing his cards very carefully indeed.
Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute, thanks very much for joining
sure.
us.
Coming up, we ask if the UN should be granted immunity in the case that demands compensation for hundreds of thousands of cholera victims in Haiti. Stay with us.
Do you ever survey a parade of shops and gathered locals and wonder why the scene is so inviting? Well, to find out, Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé ventured to Wilton Way, a small thoroughfare in East London's Hackney, to get a read on the ingredients that underpin a community.
In a former post office at number 67, Borough Wines is a perfect example of modern renewal born out of village ideals. The success of Muriel Châtel's Hackney Wine Shop is down to the daily engagement with the locals. In addition to the expertly chosen bottles on the shelves, Borough Wines provides a fill-your-bottle-at-the-barrel service offering simply one red, one white, and one rosé at a comforting price.
You can watch Tyler Brulé's Hackney Revival film in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
It's just coming up to 4:15. Now, there had not been a single case of cholera recorded in over a century in Haiti when, in 2008, a band of UN peacekeepers arrived. A subsequent outbreak of the disease killed over 8,000 people and made hundreds of thousands more sick, with the fingers of blame being pointed at leaking sewage from a camp for UN soldiers from Nepal, where cholera is endemic. Now the UN is being sued for $100,000 for every Haitian who died and $50,000 for everyone who became sick. Yet earlier this year, UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon said the petition for compensation was not receivable under a 1947 convention that grants the UN immunity for its actions. It does not look as though the UN will change its stance.
The case today in New York City was filed on behalf of victims of Haiti's cholera epidemic. Both the surviving family members of people who were killed by the epidemic and individuals who got sick but were recovered. And it was the basis for the UN's liability is that the UN allowed troops coming from Nepal, where there was an epidemic, to be sent to Haiti, even though it was known that Haiti was vulnerable to a cholera epidemic, without either testing or treating them. And once in Haiti, the troops were deployed on a base which had a septic system that by design was putting contaminated water into the top of Haiti's largest river system. And the cholera bacteria got from the soldiers into Haiti's largest river. It spread throughout the country. It has killed 8,300 people by the official estimates, which are almost certainly low, and has sickened 700,000 officially, which is also low. The cholera victims are asking for three things. First, they want the UN to install the water and sanitation infrastructure necessary to control the epidemic, because Haiti continues to lose about 1,000 people a year from the cholera epidemic, and the only way of stopping it is putting in clean water and sanitation. Second, the victims are looking for compensation. There are many families that have lost the only breadwinner in the family, and they're eating less. They have had to pull their kids out of school, which is condemning the kids to generational poverty when they can't learn their way out of poverty. And the third thing that the cholera victims are asking for is an apology from the United Nations. We have some challenges in terms of jurisdiction. The UN will claim that it has immunity, and we're going to fight that out in the district court in New York. In terms of actually proving the case, it'll probably be the easiest case that I've done in my 20 years of being a lawyer. The liability is absolutely clear. Even last night at the Martin Ennals Human Rights Award ceremony here in Geneva, the Navi Pillay, who's the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, she went on record to say that she thinks that the cholera victims should be compensated. There's a mountain of evidence, genetic tests, microbiology tests. Even the UN's own expert panel on cholera has concluded that the UN is the cause of the epidemic in Haiti. The process is likely to take at least months, probably years. The UN will undoubtedly contest the jurisdiction of the court. We'll fight it out at the district court level, and my guess is whoever loses at the district court will appeal it to the Second Circuit Appeals Court in the U.S. So I think this is a bit of a long struggle, but not as long as the struggle of Haitians against cholera, because unless the cholera is stopped, it will continue to kill hundreds of Haitians every year indefinitely. We do think we'll be successful. The liability is so clear and the damages are so great that we think that we may have some mountains to climb, but that we will eventually prevail on this case.
That was Brian Concannon, the director of the Center for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Now, Monocle's Ed Stocker also went to the country to report on the role of the UN forces for the magazine just after the cholera outbreak, and he told us recently what he found there.
I was there at the beginning of 2012, actually in February 2012. I was going essentially to cover a story for Monocle about the UN troops and about the Brazilians in particular who lead the mission out there. Basically looking at what Brazil was doing, its greater role in the world, you know, its decision and desire to play a more active role in global politics and policing, I guess. And also looking at how both Brazilian forces and the UN were viewed, you know, inside Port-au-Prince and inside Haiti as a whole, really. I arrived 2 years after the, well, just over 2 years after the January 2010 earthquake. And, you know, to be honest with you, not much had changed, you know, certainly from my perception. My hotel literally looked out onto the one of the main squares in the capital, which was a camp for displaced people, you know, still very much there 2 years after the earthquake. You know, I saw loads of different camps while I was there. There was still rubble in the streets. You were thinking, my God, it feels like this earthquake was a few months ago, not a few years ago. And obviously, you know, there was the cholera debacle, the scandal over this outbreak that's killed thousands of Haitians. I was actually there in February, which is the dry season. The numbers of casualties or recorded cases tend to dip in the dry season and get worse again when the rains come a few months after I was there, and that's when more figures tend to come about. But at the same time, you know, the cholera epidemic was still there, and you know, even today there are people affected by it. It seems, to be honest with you, that the evidence is quite clear about the role of the UN in this. Like they argue, basically they argue that they're immune, that, you know, there's an international law giving immunity to the UN. But the question is really, in an instance like this, when it seems to be pretty clear, is that actually law meant to be used for something like that? Should it accept responsibility for what happened and you know, do more in that respect? So I think, to be honest with you, the court case was a long time coming. Lawyers in both Haiti and the US have been working on this for a long time. And, you know, what they say is essentially that they've exhausted every other method. You know, the UN won't acknowledge what's happened and it's just tried to distance itself from it. And so this is almost like a last resort, going to court, you know, filing, suing, as it were, the UN.
Monocle's Ed Stocker there. And finally, we asked David Darg, the award-winning director of the documentary Baseball in the Time of Cholera, set in Haiti during the cholera outbreak, for his thoughts on the UN trial.
The co-director and myself were aid workers living and working in Haiti right after the earthquake. And we were there throughout the outbreak of cholera and were aid workers working in some of the hardest hit areas of cholera, helping to deploy water systems for water purification and working in the hospitals where the victims were coming to. So we were documenting the cholera outbreak at the same time, because we had cameras with us and we were trying to let the world know how they could respond and help financially. And at the same time, back in Port-au-Prince, we had a baseball program going for a group of young boys. And one of the young boys, his family was really seriously affected by cholera when his mother died. It really hit myself and the co-director really hard, because they were really good friends of ours. The family were good friends. And we got angry at that point, more angry than we had been. We'd been in this emergency relief mode and hadn't really considered the implications of the fact that the United Nations had brought cholera to Haiti. But at that point, when a good friend of ours died from the disease, we were really moved to anger and wanted to let the world know what a scandal this was happening before our eyes. And that's where the film Baseball in the Time of Cholera came from. We wanted to document the crisis and the scandal through the eyes of one Haitian, because the numbers are so big. You know, today, cholera has infected over 800,000 people. It's claimed around 6,000 lives. And those numbers are so huge, it's really hard to get your head around. The victims of this outbreak, of this crisis, are desperate for help. The nation in general is desperate for a solution to the crisis. There needs to be a huge financial commitment towards solving the cholera epidemic in Haiti. But for the victims themselves that have endured this horrific disease and the families that have been torn apart by cholera, there needs to be some sort of retribution and justice, especially in the form of finances, I think would be appropriate. The goal of the film was to break that down and talk about how cholera affected one family in particular, and so that people outside of Haiti in the West can really relate to the scandal and the seriousness of what's happening in Haiti.
That was documentary filmmaker David Darg sharing his thoughts on the UN's responsibility for the cholera outbreak in Haiti. It's 24 minutes past 8 in London. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, and up next we head over to Budapest.
This is Midori House, and the time now is 9:24 in Budapest and 8:24 here in London. We're off to Hungary, where joining us on the line from Budapest is our man there, Adam Labor. Adam, you've got a great article in The Economist imagining a briefing note from the special advisor Alistair McBride to David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, on the occasion of Viktor Orban's visit to London. It's a lovely piece, but there is a serious point to be made, though, isn't there, which is that perhaps Orban is seeing the wrong people here.
Yes, I thought it was very interesting that Mr. Orban's going to London and he's meeting David Cameron, the British Conservative Prime Minister. Now, as we know, the Conservative Party in Britain is a kind of centre-right, pro-business party. But really what Mr. Orban's doing in Hungary is it doesn't fit into the Conservative worldview at all. I mean, the government's been engaged with an ongoing verbal war against the International Monetary Fund. And the IMF has closed down its office here, partly because Hungary's managed to pay off its loan back to it. And at the same time, the government's really starting a new kind of political onslaught against the energy companies and is freezing and reducing energy bills, which is rather what David Miliband's doing. And there's also an increasing amount of anti-EU rhetoric, which is much more in line with Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party than of the British Tory Party.
Mind you, we have seen a bit of potentially anti-EU rhetoric being waged from the backbenches of the Tory party this week, but the point absolutely stands. Adam, your fantastic article, as Georgina said, it's very funny, it's very telling about the situation over there. You mentioned that the newest dirty word in Hungary is multi. Tell us more.
Yes, I mean, in Central Europe always loves its scapegoats, as we know through history. But the newest one is what they call the Maltese, which is short for multinational, because it's more and more the received wisdom, in large part thanks to the government's own propaganda and the things that the governments are saying, that the real enemy of the country is the multinationals, which is just completely bizarre, because obviously, while no sovereign nation wants to hand itself over to global corporations completely and shouldn't do, if you're a country of 10 million people with less people than live in Greater London, well, what, you're not going to do very well without foreign investment. And I always say to Hungarians, you know, you want to see a country without a Maltese? Well, why not take a trip to Tirana, the capital of Albania, or Chisinau in Moldova, and you can see what a city there looks like where there's no Maltese. And also, at the same time, it's quite hypocritical, because who did Mr. Orban meet when he was in London? Rightly, he met the Central Europe directors of the big firms such as Tesco, which are based here. And the other thing about the multinationals is, of course, is that they operate clean books. They don't pay people off the books with cash in little envelopes, you know, and they pay their taxes. So obviously, while we've got to keep a balance keep the multinationals, you know, under control, we're not going to do very well without them.
And it perhaps might make them even more gloomy, because there's a new ranking out. Hungary is now 110th on the gloom scale. That's behind Iraq, Serbia and Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Yes, I thought that was quite extraordinary, actually. I mean, you know, when you come to Budapest and then see the other big cities in Hungary, they're really quite buzzing. You know, they're fun places to live. They've got a great cultural life. They've got good public transport. They're easy to get around. They're safe compared to other places in Western Europe. And, you know, it's fun to live in Budapest. But, yeah, 110th most gloomy country in the world. More gloom, Hungarians, according to the survey, are more gloomy than Iraq. And people in Iraq, which I find incredible, because, you know, as we know, dozens of people are being killed all the time in Iraq in car bombings. But Hungarians are legendary for their pessimism and their gloom, and it doesn't seem to be picked up.
What's causing the pessimism and the gloom? I mean, is it the corruption? Is it freedom? What's really making them so gloomy?
Well, I think there's a sense that things aren't getting much better. I mean, the country is kind of dividing more and more. I mean, there's a thin veneer of a middle class and a kind of new rich elite with good connections to the government that are getting richer and doing very well. But a lot of people are not. And, you know, one statistic I read recently said something like 40% of the population is on or below the poverty line. Now, the poverty line is defined as 60% of the average national wage. And the average national wage is less than $1,000 a month. And if you go shopping in the supermarkets here, I mean, I've just come back from London, the prices are not wildly different. I mean, things are a little bit cheaper, but you're not looking, you know, considering, you know, that the average salary in a Western capital is probably three times that, prices are not one third of what they are in Berlin or Paris or London. And people feel that, you know, they just simply can't manage.
Adam, thank you so much. We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Adam Labor, our man in Budapest.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we're in Manchester, where the Imperial War Museum presents its first major exhibition of its national collection of contemporary art produced since the first Gulf War. And we report on the dizzying development of urban housing in Istanbul.
This is a miracle. This is the solution. People solve their own housing needs. Turkish state managed to build so many numbers of houses in 1 year, but Gecekondu people, they managed 10 times more.
But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zeidan has been seized by armed men in the capital Tripoli. Mr. Zeidan was taken from the Carinthia Hotel at dawn by gunmen to an unknown place for unknown reasons, according to a statement on the government's website. The speculation the event is linked to the capture of Anas al-Libi, a senior al-Qaeda suspect in Libya, by US forces on Saturday. The United States says it will withhold deliveries of tanks, fighter aircraft, helicopters and missiles, as well as $260 million in cash aid from Egypt's military-backed government, pending progress on democracy and human rights. The decision, described by US officials, demonstrates US unhappiness with Egypt's path since its army ousted Mohamed Morsi in July. The head of the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog says the Syrian government has so far been very cooperative with its inspectors. Ahmed Uzumcu, Director General of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, says experts still have much work to do, but he's confident they could eliminate Syria's chemical weapons by mid-2014. The father of fugitive former US intelligence contractor Edward Snowden has arrived in Russia to visit his son. Lon Snowden told journalists on his arrival in Moscow that he felt extreme gratitude that his son was safe and secure. India's trade deficit fell to a 2.5-year low in September, raising hopes for a significant reduction in the country's gaping current account deficit, which sent the rupee to record lows in recent months. Imports fell by 18.1%, while exports were up by 11.15%, bringing the trade gap down from $10.9 billion in August to $6.7 billion last month. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks, James. We'll be back later to update those stories for us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and Clemency Burton-Hill. The Imperial War Museum holds an unrivalled collection of 20th and 21st century British art. Now IWM North, part of the Imperial War Museums in Manchester, is presenting the first major exhibition of its collection of contemporary art produced since the first Gulf War, placing more than 20 years of work by over 40 artists in this national collection on public display together for the first time.
Well, curator Sarah Bevan is on the line with us here on Midori House to talk about how contemporary art and war reveals how war has been a crucial subject matter for contemporary artists in the last two decades. Sarah, good morning. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi.
Now, one of the main themes of the show is how artists can contribute globally to our perceptions of war and conflict, especially in an age where our understanding is so often shaped by the media and the internet. So how does the exhibition actually explore this?
Well, the exhibition looks at a variety of themes in the artist's work. I think it looks, you know, generally at artists who confront the media in terms of the way they present war and conflict and unpick the way that the media is kind of is packaging conflict for us. It looks at artists who make work to express and explore a political standpoint, sometimes explicitly as a protest. It also looks at artists who explore longer-term repercussions of conflict, for example, the longer-term legacy of trauma or violence, and try to do this in a way that's very different to perhaps the way that photojournalism might present that kind of subject matter. And I think it also looks at artists whose work raises ethical questions and dilemmas. So I think, you know, on the whole, it suggests a kind of that art can present a kind of longer, broader view of conflict without perhaps the need for spectacle that, you know, may be required in some forms of media.
You talk about artists protesting against war. How is that shown? Tell us about some of the work that shows protest in art form.
Well, I suppose the most explicit is a work by Kennard Phillips called Photo Op. You may be aware of it. It's been very sort of widely spread on the internet. It's a picture of Tony Blair taking a selfie with a mobile phone against a backdrop of an explosion. And it was a photo montage that they produced in response to the war in Iraq. So they felt that having protested with, you know, a million people on the streets of London, they felt quite angry that that the war then went ahead. And they felt also that their personal, you know, that their viewpoint wasn't really reflected, and the viewpoint of all of those people wasn't reflected in the sort of wider media. So they started producing work in response to this, and it's sort of very clear, you know, in terms of their feelings about Tony Blair and the Labour government.
Sorry, I'm always struck when I visit the Imperial War Museum in London, at least, that it's such a fantastic museum and it's so unexpected. So often what you find there is not at all sort of what you might presume might be there. And I wonder if there's a sort of, not an image change, but I'm wondering in terms of the audience that you might get through the door at this exhibition up in Manchester, whether you're looking at a slightly younger, more contemporary audience who will instantly be literate in the language of things like selfies, as you say, which perhaps an older audience who might have been veterans of wars themselves are not quite. Perhaps, I'm sort of trying to be polite here, but are you deliberately targeting an audience who wouldn't normally necessarily go and see an exhibition about war in a museum?
I think to a certain extent we are. I mean, I think there's a feeling across the museum that we want to be braver in some ways about the kind of material that we're presenting. But I think you're right. I think there is it is an attempt to capture the interest of perhaps a slightly different younger audience. But I think it's also to just to make it sort of our general audience more aware of the collection, you know, that we've been building up for all these years. So.
Of course, the collection has changed radically over the years, from the days in which an artist would go and set up their easel on the side of the battlefield, although some contemporary artists like Nick Bashel still do that. Are the artists that you're exhibiting here, are they actually veterans of wars themselves, most of them? Have they actually been on the battlefield, or are these perceptions from outside?
It's quite a mixture, actually. Some of them are artists who've been commissioned by IWM as as artists who have travelled to various sort of frontline situations. So people like Langlands and Bell or Paul Seawright, who both travelled to Afghanistan. There are other artists whose work comes out of a much more kind of personal experience of conflict. So, for example, John Kindness has produced this amazing suit of armour called Sectarian Armour, which is reflecting on the subject of, the symbols of Northern Irish sectarianism. And so obviously that's coming from a very personal experience, but, you know, he hasn't had the kind of experience in any kind of military sense. But I think there's also a lot of work which is perhaps broadening our idea of what conflict actually is. So, you know, thinking about conflict as being purely that kind of frontline combat experience, I think is maybe a bit limiting. And so there are lots of artists who look at the longer term legacy, so how we remember conflict, the kind of later repercussions of war in everyday life, I suppose.
Sara Bevan, the curator of Catalyst, Contemporary Art and War, that will open at Imperial War Museum North in Manchester this weekend. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
We'll be back right after this with a report on Istanbul's Geçikondo neighbourhoods that appear overnight on squatted land.
the perfect way to start the day on the East Coast, or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
You're listening to Midori House, where the time now is 8:39 here in London. Well, there's no denying the current speed of urbanisation in Istanbul. From new airports to new bridges, the city is transforming at a dizzying rate, and not without protest. The roots of urban planning in modern Istanbul can be found in informal housing units known as geyşekondo, entire neighbourhoods built overnight on squatted land, which blossomed in the city during the population boom of the 1950s and 60s.
Over the years, geyşekondo neighbourhoods have developed tight-knit communal bonds and demonstrated successful grassroots urban planning. But now developers are targeting them for regeneration. For this week's edition of The Urbanist, Monocle's Joseph Dana reports on how the geyşekondo have gone from being the darling of Istanbul's urbanisation to the target of new Istanbul land desires.
Scattered throughout Istanbul's rapidly changing urban landscape, small neighbourhoods that were informally created hide in the most unlikely of places. Venture into one of these dense neighbourhoods, known in Turkish as geyşekondo, or built at night, and the sense of community on its most grassroots level is profound. Today, these informal areas have been formalized. But not so long ago, geyşekondo were denoted by simple one- or two-story structures better suited for the country than the city. The geyşekondo are the most visible legacy of the city's last period of rapid urbanization.
Geyşekondo is all about speed, because the name itself suggests that built overnight.
That is Yaşar Adanoğlu, an Istanbul-based urban scholar who teaches in Germany.
So it's such a speed that we could not find now, even in the global city in the making, that the towers are rising up. But this is a phenomenon that, because of its lack of security of tenure and any the threat of evictions and demolitions, once it has been built, they had to be fast. So the newcomers to the city, they need to sort out their housing need, and legally they couldn't do that, so they have to build their house at night so that their roof were there that couldn't be demolished without a warning from the court, so they could earn some time to develop their neighborhoods. So geyşekondo literally means built overnight.
What began as a haphazard practice in the 1950s, when Istanbul experienced a population boom as a result of the industrialization of Turkey, the geyşekondo slowly became formalized by the city. With migrants pouring into the city from rural Turkey, and the government unable to provide accommodation, informal housing was a natural solution. Small structures better suited for the country gave way to legalized buildings as demand for housing in Istanbul increased over the years. According to Selva Gurduan, a co-founder of the Istanbul design and urbanism studio Superpool, the city is in a post-geyşekondo phase.
In Istanbul, the one or two-story geyşekondo period is mostly over. You will maybe find, I don't know the exact number, but you won't find more than a handful of neighborhoods that actually have this sort of the classic, let's say, geyşekondo typology of one to two-story buildings, more like village houses built very fast without much infrastructure. What has happened in place of it through the legalization processes is that they actually turned into neighborhoods with four or five-story apartment buildings, which are pretty much preserved the original geyşekondo plots, so they're tiny in footprint, and they're quite haphazardly built. and we have massive neighborhoods of this post-Gecekondo type of building and urban tissue.
As with any informal area in a megacity, the problems with the Gecekondo concern safety and building codes. In Istanbul, this also means earthquake readiness. Informality was once heralded by the Turkish government as a sign of ingenuity, as Turks individually creating urban solutions, but it is now used as a pretext to allow for the development of the Gecekondo areas in Istanbul. Sila Akap agrees. She's an architect with the Tak Design Collective, located in Kadıköy in Istanbul.
Gecekondos are, of course, illegal buildings, but in like 80s, they started to be legal, and people extended these areas, buildings. But the problem is there was no infrastructure. Quality of life was high. Quality of urban space, green spaces was high. But because of infrastructure and proper planning, these areas turned into very unquality areas in time.
The Turkish government's plans for a new global Istanbul require land and transportation arteries, and the Gecekondo areas are ripe sources. Under the banner of safety and earthquake readiness, the government is targeting various Gecekondo areas for redevelopment while portraying the neighborhoods as overly dense and unattractive. But Yaşar Adanoğlu disagrees with this assessment. He remembers a time when the government cheered the Gecekondo and respected the strong communities that live in Gecekondo areas.
I prefer not to define Gecekondo as a problematic concept. For me, that is a solution. And if you look at the 1950s parliament discussions in Ankara, actually, you know, it's a very new phenomena, and the member of parliaments, they are just facing this informal housing in a mainly rural country. The urbanization just kicked off. People start moving in the cities, and just all these houses are popping up in the hills of Ankara, Istanbul, major cities, and they are trying to make sense of it in this very modernist new republic. No, like, what this phenomena? How are we going to deal with it? Are we going to wipe them out? But we don't have the capital as the state to provide them the social housing. So what's going to happen? So when you look at their language, it is like, this is a miracle. This is the solution. People solve their own housing needs. Turkish state managed to build so many numbers of houses in 1 year, but Gecekondo people, they managed 10 times more.
While the Gecekondo might not be the most pressing issue in Istanbul, it certainly provides a longue durée on the urbanism in the city over the last 60 years. Undoubtedly, the Gecekondo, despite being built overnight in some cases, are areas that people want to live in. They represent grassroots urban initiatives that have successfully balanced the needs of the community with few available resources, and they have done this with speed. Ironically, a battle is taking shape between the residents of the Gecekondo, the embodiment of Istanbul's last phase of rapid urbanization, and the developers of Istanbul's current phase of urbanization. The history of informal settlement in cities doesn't bode well for the Gecekondo. For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
And you can catch more reports from this week's speed-themed Urbanist when the show goes on air at 1900 hours London time tonight.
It's 47 minutes past the hour, but before we leaf through the European newspapers this morning, we just have time for a spot of music. This is Éolienne by Gaëtan Roussel. That was Éolienne by Gaëtan Roussel. Well, very sadly, we're inching towards the close of today's Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Georgina Godwin. But it's time now to take a look at the European press. before we close the show, and I'm delighted to say that Monocle's Alexa Firmenich joins us in the studio. She's got the French, Swiss and Spanish newspapers. Good morning, Alexa.
Good morning.
Shall we start in Spain and their newest political party, Partido X, which has been rather kept under wraps since it was founded? Have they finally revealed themselves? Who are they?
They have. So it's a political party that was founded last year. And during the time they were founded, they kept everything very mysterious. They refused to show their faces and who they were. And they had their first campaign on Tuesday. So they finally revealed who they were. And it's a massive group of people from the ages of 18 to 80. You have scientists, teachers, students, retirees. And basically, they arose out of this Indignados movement as a result of the economic crisis and a lot of political disenfranchisement. People in Spain, actually, their second largest concern after the economy is political corruption. So they've come along sort of as a group to fill this gap because people are they don't trust the two leading parties, and they've been in control for 30 years, which is a very long time. And their campaign, they're coming along and they're saying our policy is democracy, full stop. They haven't really come out with a very clear set of what they're actually going to do or a clear policy. But I think that, you know, at least they showed their face on Tuesday, which is a start.
Yeah. How popular are they?
I think it's tough to tell. I mean, they get their funds through crowdfunding. So it's tough to tell where their money comes from or who's behind them. They're hoping to get over 1 million votes in the upcoming European elections, but we'll see how that turns out. And actually, their anti-corruption drive is being led by Hervé Falciani, who's a former Swiss bank employee, and he's quite famous because he revealed a lot of secret bank account information about tax evaders.
And they've also got a big Brazilian connection.
Yeah, they have Tarso Genro, who's a former minister of Da Silva's. And so, I mean, they have a lot of big names in there and a lot of small names, but it's just interesting to see, you know, Partido X. It sounds like something quite mysterious.
You mentioned that political instability is high up on the agenda for the Spanish. Is there a sense that the kind of instability that we're seeing is going to be an echo of what we've seen in Greece and in Italy and Portugal recently?
Well, I mean, that's what the piece is saying, and that's what people are saying. You know, when you bring in parties like this, or, I mean, as you saw in Italy as well, it's just, if they don't have a very clear set of outlines and what they're going to do, then it's just going to polarize people behind, you know, what kind of cause.
You could argue that if the mainline political parties weren't in such a state of disarray, there would be no need for these sorts of parties. Let's move over to France and Libération and a story about the Eden Theatre.
Yeah, so this is actually the world's oldest cinema. And it showed back in the day a film by the Lumière brothers, who screened the very first moving picture of a train arriving at the local train station. That was in 1899. And actually, this is quite a cute story. Legend has it that when the film was shown, spectators were so terrified that they leaped out of their seats at the image of this train coming towards them. But yeah, so it's been closed since 1995. And it just opened yesterday. It cost 6 million euros to renovate. And it's part of the Marseille European Capital of Culture 2013. But before that, they didn't really have the funds to actually put into reopening the cinema.
They just got in there with a few months left of 2013.
Yeah.
And what does the new cinema look like?
Velvet seats, refurbished oak floors. It sounds quite luxurious.
The Lumière brothers presumably wouldn't recognise it now.
It'll be quite a challenge, I would think, obviously with the whole city, capital city of culture, it'll have an audience. But after that, presumably quite an economic challenge to keep it going.
Definitely. And I mean, that's one of the big, you know, fears and arguments of the whole capital of culture in general and in the Marseille area. And it's actually quite interesting because, so this cinema opened in the south of France, and then in Paris you have a lot of massive, massive new multiplex cinemas that are going to open as well. 40 new screens will be unveiled in the coming weeks, which is huge development. And there's a huge one that's being constructed by Luc Besson near Charles de Gaulle Airport, and he's a very famous French filmmaker. And it's said to be inspired by cinema amusement parks that exist in Israel and Eastern Europe.
Is there a sense that in the wake of the onslaught from the digital world and the fact that people can watch Netflix or any other film provider, you know, they can stream a movie on their computer at any given moment, that cinemas have to become more than just screens and more than just cinemas to stay alive?
Well, I mean, I think that there's two two directions. One of them is, yes, people go to the cinema for the experience, to get food in their seats, to have the surround sound system.
But and I a think, big screen.
Yeah, of course. But I think there is also the aspect of a smaller independent movie cinema, which is quite threatened by being able to stream things online or by going to these massive multiplexes. And in France, they've always been very worried about keeping that small cinema industry alive. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah. Alexa, finally, it's not an area we often go to here on Monocle 24, bird watching or ornithology, but there's new research from Switzerland, some amazing stats about the native alpine swift.
Yeah, so last year, some scientists attached little geolocators to these alpine swifts, and they discovered that they can fly for 7 months without stopping. They sleep in flight, they eat in flight. I don't know how they can do it.
It sounds quite extraordinary. Yeah. Now, Switzerland actually has a history of bird tracking.
Yeah, so we have this very famous bird called Max the Stork, who's the grand old lady of Swiss bird research. Unfortunately, she was found dead last year, half-eaten, at quite an old age. But she was really well-known in Switzerland. Around 6,000 people subscribed to the museum's newsletter following her progress. And she was tracked since the age of 2 months to the age of 13 years, which is a very, very long lifespan for a stork.
Yeah. Who knew? We're going to have to leave it there. Alexa Fermanu from Monocle, thank you so much for joining us on the papers this morning.
And thanks to our producer, Daphne Denis, our researchers, Gaia Lutz and Harriet Thorpe, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is Culture with Rob Bound, and I'll be back with the Continental Shift at 10 London time. And then stay tuned for The Briefing. That's at noon in London and at 7 a.m. in New York. And of course, Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Georgina Godwin.
And me, Clemency Burton-Hill. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.